What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's also you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And we don't just mean the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out, the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
Hi, everyone. Sophia Bush here. Welcome to Work in Progress, where I talk to people who inspire me about how they got to where they are and where they think they're still going. Okay, y'all. Lisa Ling is so badass. If you haven't watched her CNN series, This Is Life, you have to check it out. It is the most inspiring, moving, and informative thing on TV right now. She travels around the country exploring all sorts of topics from porn to gender fluidity to prison to twins and so much more. I loved talking to her about her journalism career, how she got started, and how she sees the impact of the ever-changing nature of how we view the truth. She got her start as a reporter in high school. She shared an office with Anderson Cooper at Channel One and then went on to work for Oprah. I asked all about them both and, of course, how she's led this incredible career. We covered so much, and I know you'll find her as inspiring and exciting as I do. Well, thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
I'm just so excited that you're here. I don't know if you remember it, but I remember it because I've been such a fan of yours for, I don't even remember a time when I wasn't, which is interesting because neither of us is that old, but.
Oh, I'm quite a bit older, but anyway.
But you're really not. And it's funny to me because I guess so many of my memories of the powerful journalists who affected me revolve around stories that I watched from you, stories that I watched from Oprah, stories that I watched from Diane Sawyer and Barbara Walters. You are the iconography of women in journalism to me. And a couple of years ago, we were at a lunch, which I believe Cindy Levy, the editor of Glamour at the time, was throwing at this great place here in LA, the Sunset Tower Hotel. It's this, you know, for our listeners, it's this sort of, you know, chic bastion of like art deco Hollywood culture. It's super cool. And there's this beautiful view of LA. And all these amazing women were there. And I turned around and I saw you. And right in your face, I went, I love you. It just came out of me. I was so excited to meet you. And you were just, and still obviously are, just the kindest, most genuine person. And you were so sweet in response. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you. I didn't expect to be so flattered coming in here, but I so appreciate that. And to even mention my name, you know, alongside the likes of Diane Sawyer and Oprah and Barbara Walters is so humbling, and because they also have been such idols of mine for so long. And I've been doing the work that I do for a long time, and I've been really, really lucky to be able to tell stories with some substance. Mm-hmm. And I feel now in this environment, more defiant about the need to continue telling these kinds of stories because we're just amidst such a culture of ugliness and vitriol and hatred, and it's really scary to me.
Me too. When you talk about it feeling defiant, can you expand on that a little more?
I've never felt more strongly about the work that I do than now. Maybe also as a mother of two girls, but also, you know, we are now living in these bubbles, these siloed bubbles, where we're not willing to hear each other anymore. I mean, I don't know about you, but I have fallen victim to just following people who espouse the same views that I do on social media. And so when you exist in that bubble, I think it's really, really hard to not only hear what other people are saying, but understand where people are coming from. We just have become so predisposed now to just shutting it down or discounting it entirely if it's not in line with how we feel. And I just think that there's real danger to that. And look, I'm as guilty as anyone for doing it. I'm a human being and I like to surround myself with people who have like values. But I think that we are getting to a point right now where, you know, we've reached a crisis point now and that we have to start listening to each other and hearing each other or I'm afraid of the potential catastrophic impact if we don't.
I am too. It can feel really overwhelming. And I think, to your point, I can see what silos I exist in. And because of some of that, I've tried to be very intentional about expanding the circles through which I view the world, following some very conservative analysts and following activists who work in certain cause-related spaces that are not the spaces that I have dedicated my life to, but are still so valid, simply to start looking at the way that these systems overlap, because we do. This idea that there are two Americas, I understand, but I also think is such a dangerous falsehood, because we're all in this together. And even this idea that people say something, that phrase, it couldn't happen here, when talking about what's going on in other parts of the world. But I think we then miss it, because if it's happening on the globe, it's happening to all of us. And perhaps the tendency to rest or back into the more tribalistic parts of our brains is because the world does feel big and overwhelming. And perhaps some of the tendency is in our DNA. You know, I just got to spend some time with a really incredible doctor, one of those people who's like, I've got four PhDs and six doctorates. And I was like, okay, I've done nothing with my life. And she's this incredible clinical researcher who was explaining some big mental health ideas, talking about trauma, talking about certain personality disorders. So we really got nerdy. And she confirmed to me that not only is there this idea of generational inheritance, but that doctors now can actually see the ways in which certain patterns are inherited. So if your grandparent experienced trauma, you have inherited trauma from them. That experience, which actually changed the way their DNA codes, was given to you in your DNA. And I'm fascinated by this, because I think about how much it really means we're all connected, how much it really means that all of these experiences shape all of us, that as women, what our mothers went through is in us and creates an instinct. And oppressed communities have generational trauma that can be tracked. And we all are living in this big, complicated soup together. And if we don't start being able to have these conversations in ways where we can lay it out on the table, we can look at the things we may not agree with people on, but also talk about what we do, talk about our commonality, and then figure out how to compromise to move forward, I don't know what happens. I feel like then we just become these tiny pockets of you know, these virtual civil wars that
Yeah, and I think there's never been a better time to talk about exactly this, because if in fact there is a generational link to those who feel they inhabit, you know, an oppressed community or they're part of an oppressed community, I think how we respond to that is really important. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that right now I think social media has a lot to do with this. I mean, you know, I'd be curious to know how the woman you were talking to feels about social media, because in so many ways, social media, our devices have just turned everything, you know, this sort of course of humanity on its head, because it is igniting things in all of us that aren't really normal, you know? And so I think there are all these movements that are happening right now that are exciting and that are purposeful. Me Too, for example. There is increased awareness and momentum behind the fight against racism, right? But at the same time, there's a lot of blame that's being placed on people. And in some ways, I think it's unfair because it's not productive. I'm currently working on an episode for a future season about what I believe is a crisis of is a boy crisis, because I think that there is a generation of young men right now who are growing up feeling or being made to feel like they are part of this oppressive class. They're afraid to speak out about anything. They're afraid to defend themselves if they feel they deserve to defend themselves. And I think that that is resulting in a lot of young men seeking out these, you know, white supremacist groups, gangs, these other kinds of tribes. You know, it's interesting you mentioned this sort of tribal culture that, you know, human beings have kind of descended from, right? I think now we are because of social media and because of everything that's happening in the world, we're wanting to sort of seek those tribes out. But if your energy, if your anger is channeled in the wrong direction, it can so easily result in seeking out these kinds of really dangerous kinds of tribes. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think that our kind of response to everything that's happening right now is really, really is really crucial. It's easy to blame, right? But what is the productive answer to the things that are happening now? And the only way we can achieve that or get to that place, I think, is through meaningful dialogue. And we're just not having that because we're so, you know, we've dug ourselves into these holes.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's a real kind of reckoning. You know, there's theories about when, as humans, we make these evolutionary jumps. And right before a jump or an adaptation, it can be very chaotic. And I think, to your point, it's so important that we are having conversations about all of these systems, which have really stood to harm a lot of people in the world. But there are so many of them. And it can, at times, feel like people really only care about the system that oppresses them. And then we just have all these people who are angry for different reasons, all yelling about why they're angry. And I'm really glad we're all yelling. And I'm hoping we can all, again, listen to each other and create some sort of cohesive plan to move a larger society forward.
Yeah.
And I had a conversation with a friend of mine who is an incredible mentor in my life and an amazing figure in all of the women's movements, not just the most recent one. And something dawned on me while we were speaking, because she was giving me some perspective on over the last 40, 50 years of activism, where she sees the fear as women fight for their own power, where she sees the fear come from in men. And I had this wild realization where I went, oh, is it that the men are afraid we would do to them what they've done to us? Oh, is that why the demand for equality can feel to those who've been in power like oppression? Is that what creates this confusing schism for these younger men who go, I don't think I'm all bad. Are you saying that if the future is female, I get left behind?
Right.
And we as women have to do better at talking about when there's a slogan out there, when there's a t-shirt that says the future is female, the word male is literally included in the word female.
Right.
Women are fighting so hard for equal representation. And I think we can forget when men are afraid that to us, we have, at least for me, I know I do, I have the core belief of I would never do to you what a patriarchal system has done to my sister.
Right, right.
And we have to be reassured.
It's a natural tendency to be afraid. And I think that's what's driving our politics right now, right?
Yeah.
It's you react when you're scared, right?
And that's being really taken advantage of.
Absolutely.
We have political leaders who understand that they can galvanize fear to create this boiling point where people will act irrationally and often in the best interests of the politicians and not the people.
Right.
And it's unfortunate when a society is being taken advantage of by its leaders in that way.
And it doesn't have to be a fight, right? There doesn't have to be a winner. You know, someone said once, I can't exactly cite the quote, but when one gender wins, we all lose.
Yes.
Right? Because if we are going to talk about equality, it can't be at the expense of the other gender.
We had a great guest on the podcast, Jay Shetty, who is an incredible speaker, and he's got just the coolest perspective. And he talks about something in his marriage, which I think actually is the micro version of the macro way we need to look at society. He talks about how he and his wife always, when they're looking at a problem, they sit together and say, it's you and me against the problem. It's we against this. It's not you versus me. The problem is not a thing that exists between us. It's its own entity over here, and we have to be on the same team to solve it. And I would love for us to be able to look at the problems of society and say, but we're on the same team.
Could we ever get to that place?
Well,
I mean, it's such a utopic, you know,
that's vision the inner of the optimist
world, but I listen, I would love to live in that world too, because it is true. I mean, we are all part of the same race. And when we continue to sort of perpetuate, you know, this hostility along race lines or along gender lines, it's just like it serves no purpose, you know, and it just, I don't know. I mean, it's really destructive.
Well, and I think there's something that fascinates me is looking at the reality that two things can be true at the same time, that people need spaces where their identity can be recognized, and that we need to recognize that we all are part of one larger identity. And I always like to ask people when we get started about who they were as kids. And you and I have just delved right into everything, which I knew that we would. And I love it. But I'm like, God, her brain is so good. But it does make me curious, because I want to know about who you were as a child. I know you as this brilliant and observational and nuanced, soulful human. And I wonder if you were all of those things when you were 7 or 8. And when we
Definitely
talk about,
not.
No, I thought you were. But when
I
we
hate
talk
to
about,
burst your bu-
when we talk about identity, though, I wonder what your experience also is as a Chinese American, and as a woman, because your culture is important, and there is also the reality of your culture, and then the desire to assimilate. And in a way, I would imagine there are lessons from your childhood that apply to this conundrum of how do we recognize that we're all the same, and how do we hold on to who we are in the ways that we are different, and to our culture and to our heritage, because that's important too.
Absolutely. And I when I really think back on it, I do think that the conflict that I felt or experienced as a young 7-year-old has mm-hmm. everything to do with how I see the world or how I envision the world that I want to live in. Mm. I grew up in Northern California, outside of Sacramento, in a very non-diverse community, and we didn't have a lot of money. My parents divorced when I was 7.
Okay.
And I always felt conflicted about my identity because I didn't feel totally American because my house always smelled like Chinese food, and I obviously looked different than all of my friends, and I was reminded of the fact that I looked different from them all the time.
How does that present when you're a little kid?
Oh,
where do those reminders come from?
Oh, I mean, I was teased a lot. It wasn't mm-hmm. malicious, but because I looked different, and kids are kids, mm-hmm. you know, I was called, you know, Risa Ring was my nickname. and kids would constantly kind of come up to me and you know, make these sounds like, oh, Risa Ring, and, you know, stuff like that. Again, it wasn't malicious. They were just being kids. But when you grow up kind of experiencing those things and really loathing how that felt, I think it kind of drives you in a certain way. But I didn't feel entirely American because I didn't look like my friends. And I didn't feel Chinese because ultimately I didn't know the first thing about being Chinese because I was American. I was born in California. And whenever I was with people who were from any part of Asia, I just could not relate at all. And so I grew up, I remember that word conflict is sort of the definitive word of to describe my childhood because I didn't know where I belonged. And I longed for that tribe too, and I just didn't have that.
Was that something you could talk to your parents about? Could you ask them about their experiences before they immigrated here?
You know, as a kid, I just didn't really have
the language.
The language, it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And again, my parents were divorced when I was 7, and my mom moved to Los Angeles. And even though she was still part of our lives, and when I say we, I'm including my sister in this conversation, who was 4 when my parents divorced. She definitely wasn't a regular part. She wasn't part of the day to day. And my dad worked all the time, so my grandmother was with us, and she was a very educated woman, but also a very strong evangelical. And so, the Bible was a big part of our childhood. Singing hymns was a big part of our childhood. In fact, on Halloween night, my grandmother would make us turn out all the lights and sing hymns to drown out all of the all the trick-or-treaters.
Wow.
Yeah, it was that hardcore.
So you never got to get candy.
I mean, we snuck out a couple of times and did it when she got older, and when we got older, she became pretty senile at a certain point. But yeah, that's the world that I grew up in. So wow. Very, you know, on the one hand, very closed-minded on so many levels, but also with this real conflict, not knowing where I belonged. And so I started working on television when I was young. I auditioned for a teen magazine show when I was 16, and
How
did I find out about
that? Yes, how does a 16-year-old
It was kind of like American Idol
happening.
Before. A speech teacher told the class about auditions at a local mall for a teen magazine show that might eventually become syndicated. And so I showed up, auditioned, and I was chosen as one of the 4 hosts out of about 500 kids that showed up and auditioned. And that gave me an opportunity to intern in the newsroom because it was produced by a local news affiliate. But it wasn't until I turned 18 that I auditioned for another show called Channel One News, which is seen in schools across the country, purportedly by about 8.5 million students every day. Anderson Cooper, who's on CNN, was one of my colleagues.
Yes.
The idea was to bring on these young-looking correspondents. We were kind of like 90210 before 90210 to report news for a high school audience. So they wanted these sort of young-looking reporters.
Yeah, kids that felt like just the age group above the viewers.
Exactly. Yeah. And having never traveled because we didn't have the resources to do so, it was the most incredible, eye-opening illuminating experience because it exposed me to the world in such a profound way. You know, I wasn't visiting tourist attractions. I was reporting on the Russian referendum elections or the civil war in Afghanistan or stories about globalization in China, in India. You know, I did this in my late teens and early 20s. And
so were you traveling to these places as part of Channel One?
Yeah.
Wow.
While I was in college at USC. And so I eventually dropped out because I felt like I was acquiring a graduate school education in my travels. But it was that experience at Channel One that propelled me to want to communicate what I was seeing to a bigger audience.
Wow. So I want to get more into Channel One, but I have a question about this sort of interim time.
Yeah.
You're between this childhood mm-hmm. where you're growing up, as you said, in a close-minded household, and then you go out to become a news reporter, which requires curiosity and expansive thought. And I wonder about how you wound up there. Were you very curious about these systems you were living in, about community and about family? Were you asking a lot of questions, let's say from, you know, 8 to 15? How did that spark for you?
So I have always had an insatiable curiosity. But it really, I don't believe I started really asking those questions until later. You know, what happened for me in my late teens and early 20s when I started getting just exposed to the rest of the world. I mean, I was 21 years old when I went to the front lines of the civil war in Afghanistan and had a 10-year-old boy point an RPG at me. And so,
wow.
You know, those are experiences that you can't erase, right? And so I realized after experiencing so many of these things that this is where I just felt like I was kind of thriving in those kinds of environments. I felt more alive. And that's something that I continue to really relish about what I'm able to do, whether it's going to Afghanistan or going and spending time with a community that is just completely different from my own in Wichita, right? Mm-hmm. I feel alive. My senses are heightened. And in our country today, in the world really, we are trying not to feel. We're afraid of feeling. You know, if we're feeling scared, if we're feeling anxiety, if we're feeling uneasy, there's a pill for that. You know, let's just medicate you so you don't have to feel. And for me, my whole life, it's just been the opposite. It's when I'm in environments that are unfamiliar to me, like I love how that feels. And it's not always that I feel good or that I feel excited. Sometimes I'm horrified by the conditions around me. Sometimes I can't stand the food that's being given to me. Sometimes my heart just feels like, you know, it's being torn out of my body. But it's so important to feel those things. And I think we've kind of gotten away from that, or somehow we are afraid of feeling. And I think it's really unfortunate because it's really that's really driven me.
Yeah. Oh God, I identify with that so much. In all the traveling I've chosen to do and the communities I've chosen to visit and the places that I always want to go, when I'm advocating for something, I want to go and see it myself. I want to go and talk to the people there myself because it feels necessary to bear witness, to use my platform in the most respectable and authentic and accurate way to talk to a larger audience that I have the privilege of talking to about these things happening in the world. And as you talk about how it makes you feel alive, whether good or bad, in the feeling you're experiencing, I really get that.
Yeah, and when we first started talking, when I said that social media and these devices have turned it all upside down, there is nothing that compares to what you can access on your device. Nothing. No landscape, no experience, because we are so just like, we are so overstimulated. We can access anything. Our brains just, they weren't built to process all of this. And so I think increasingly people are feeling less and less because they are so embroiled in their social world, in their world of social media, and people aren't going out and having those experiences because they don't feel like they need to, but yet they feel like they have a platform though to be able to kind of pontificate about, you know, what have you. And it's kind of a just an unprecedented period that we're living in that regard.
It's wild.
I'm
just so curious about where we go, and
now they're talking about, you know, this virtual reality so that people don't even have to travel. They can just sit on their couches and get exposed to, you know, different parts of the world or whatever they want to do sexually, you know, and it's.
But then we're missing it. We're missing the actual experience.
Absolutely.
We're missing the people that you run into, the street food you wind up eating, the conversation you wind up having, the wrong turn you take that leads you somewhere you weren't expecting to go. It's the connectivity and really, I think, the magic that goes away the more we view the world through a screen.
Absolutely. I mean, just the spontaneity of life. Mm. And again, those feelings that you can only get when you don't know what's going to happen, right? And my fear as we kind of progress along this path is just that already young people are feeling less empathy or the inability to be empathetic than ever before because they're numbing themselves with video games or whatever drugs that they choose to pursue. And, you know, I want to ignite this quest for people to really start feeling.
Yes.
Because I just can't convey more strongly how important it is to be able to do.
Yes.
I mean, remember when we were kids and we would get so excited about calling, you know, a boy or, you know, that like all of that doesn't even happen anymore. And when you'd finally get on the phone, you'd have to actually speak and communicate. Mm-hmm. Like that just doesn't happen. And it's like picking away at feeling and being able to experience the full range of your emotions.
Ooh, yeah.
I know we're going in a lot of directions here.
and I love it. And I think you have such a unique perspective also on how these new experiences are shaping and shifting culture because you've been investigating it for as long as you have. And when you talk about being 21 and being out on assignment for Channel One and going to places like Afghanistan, you did that and were able to dive into those communities and come home and metabolize what you saw and talk about the feeling and talk about the political reality and you could really pontificate on geopolitical issues and human issues in a way that in my memory felt more grounded and more informative. You know, prior to the Bush-Cheney era, you couldn't have partisan news. You just couldn't have that. The news was presented as fact
first,
and then people could come on to debate, to talk about different sides of policy, but there was never the ability for a news organization to judge the facts before presenting them.
Yeah,
It's really
unfair to call news, or at least broadcast news, news, because it's now just straight opinion. Mm-hmm. And
it feels like a cage match. When I watch the news, I feel like I'm watching ESPN.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I'm watching news. It's been designed to feel like sport.
And again, when was the last time you were out with people, right? Embedded in communities, but yet somehow, for some reason, you've been given this really precious position to kind of spew your opinion for the masses to absorb and to envelop as fact. And yeah, I just, for me, I think the reason why I feel so emphatic about this kind of work is, you know, again, just, I spend an equal amount of time in my home, but also just in the world, with people who, in my wildest dreams, I never imagined I'd be hanging out with or spending time with or having dinner with, but I develop a relationship with those people as a result that is so unique and important. And I feel a responsibility to tell their stories accurately. And I just, I think we all need to do that more.
Yes.
Just traveling to, we don't even have to leave our own country to feel like we're in another foreign territory.
Yes.
You know, if we just travel to the middle of the country and vice versa.
And you, and so many of the great thinkers have that experience. You know, you talk about your travel, your Channel One coworker, Anderson Cooper, travels. I think about Gloria Steinem writing on the road. I think about even John Steinbeck, you know, one of my favorite authors.
Absolutely.
Who had this awakening in his later life, realizing he'd become this famous writer on America. And it had been so long since he'd been in America. And he got a camper for his truck and threw his dog in the back and kissed his wife goodbye and said, I got to go explore. And in his 60s, road tripped around America again to go to tiny towns and campsites and just be with people. And it's so crucial that if we're going to write about experience, if we're going to advocate for people, if we're going to make plans for people, that we know those people.
Yeah.
When you guys were out traveling in that Channel One era, I am so curious, just as a fan of the both of you, I'm thinking about you and Anderson out there on the road. What is that experience like? And, you know, you're 21 years old. Are you guys going to bars? Are you, what are you doing? What is your personal life when you're as a journalist at 21 traveling the globe? What is that? How do you date? What's your social life? I'm so curious.
Well, dating was, and you know, I mean, I'm married now, but it's always been a challenge because I come back from these crazy, unbelievable experiences and want to talk to people about it. But I think inevitably it kind of made people feel not insecure, but I just don't really have anything to say. I can't really contribute to the conversation. And so you just kind of just compartmentalize. And that was particularly challenging in relationships, especially because I would go out with guys who I think fancy themselves as like masculine guys. And I come back and I, you know, just jumped out of helicopters with, you know, Colombian narco police into cocaine infested laboratories in the jungles. And they're kind of like, whoa, I don't really know what to say.
You turn the paradigm over and they don't know how to react.
So I've always just kind of kept my circles very tight. My sister is also a journalist, so she and I probably talk on the phone 5 times a day at least. And I've just always I've always been the kind of person, because I interact with so many people, to just keep my kind of inner circle pretty tight.
Yeah, what is it like when you talk about the relationships that you build with these people, these communities that you visit? Do you have to have a sort of boundary, almost like a doctor does, where you can't allow a continued expectation of a relationship after a story, or can you keep up with people?
It's a great question, and it's a tough one to answer because I give my cell phone number to just about anyone that I spend time with and we profile, because what they've shared with me is often so deeply personal. It's more personal than they've ever shared with even their closest friends or family members. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I have an obligation to maintain contact with these people because they've done that. They've shared that with me. And I take that responsibility very seriously. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, I feel closer to them for them having shared this with me than I even feel with some of my own friends or people I call friends, because we just go to that place. Mm. And my husband, he thought it was pretty funny that our wedding, we both have huge families. And so when we got married, we just decided, let's invite everyone. Let's just have a big party and just invite everyone. So I had, you know, a family that we profiled who lost their house in Hurricane Katrina. We had a family who adopted Chinese, you know, girls who I had stayed in contact with. We had a bunch of police officers. We had some drug counselors because the relationships that I build with these people, they're real relationships because of what people have shared with me. And I am so fortunate to be able to have these kinds of relationships. And I don't stay in touch with everyone that I've ever profiled, but they all have my number and can text or call me. And, you know, I have a text thread going right now of this man that I profiled when I was working for the Oprah show. His entire family was addicted to heroin. His wife eventually succumbed to addiction, her addiction. He ended up incarcerated, but he texts me all the time to tell me that he just got his union license. He sends me pictures of the house that he's building. He told me he just bought his dad's truck from him, the first vehicle he's ever bought. And I cherish those text messages from those people. And I get them randomly, but I cherish them.
Yeah. When someone really trusts you with their truth, it's such an intimate experience. And how beautiful it must be to really get to cultivate that repeatedly with people, especially because you choose to bear witness in a lot of communities that people aren't paying attention to. So there's such a gift in hearing people.
Well, that's the gist of my work.
Yes.
And again, I fall into the trap of you know, listening to people who, again, espouse the same values that I do. But when it comes to my work, I really, really try hard to put my judgment aside and just hear people. Yeah. And it really has been enlightening for me to do that. I've even embedded with a militia, you know, a bunch of guys who are defiant about their Second Amendment rights, and they let me embed with them because they knew that even though I vehemently oppose, you know, I have visceral feelings about gun control and whether people should possess, you know, assault weapons, they knew I would give them a fair shot and allow them to talk, right? They knew that I would not be exploitative. Mm-hmm. I might express my feelings, but I would give them a chance to talk. And that's what we really try to do. Mm-hmm. I don't know that a lot of shows really do that. Mm-hmm. I look at myself as just the vehicle through which people can experience things, and I might hold your hand to introduce you to people that you might otherwise never encounter, but I'm not going to tell you what to think, and I'm not going to make the story about me. I'm going to give you a chance to get to know people that you might not otherwise have the time or have the desire to get to know. Mm. And who knows, in the end, you might walk away feeling a little bit differently, or you might find that you can relate to these people in ways that you might not have otherwise ever thought you could.
Yeah, it's so cool. It's such a service, really. And I think a reminder. And I am curious because obviously you're in this space where you are comfortable getting so personal with people. But I remember, these are my moments where I just am an unabashed fan, where I'm like, well, I remember when this happened to you because I read the article. I remember, you know, when you started on The View, coming in from this space as a journalist and then coming in to still be a journalist, but to share of yourself in a different way.
That was hard.
Yeah. There was this expectation that you were just going to open up about every aspect of your life. And you got asked a question immediately that made you very uncomfortable. I don't know if you want to talk about that or not. But how do you do that? And what's the shift? Because, you know, you were at USC. You are a journalist. I also went to USC. I don't know if we've ever talked about this.
I did not know that.
I get very excited about it. I'm like, Annenberg for life. Yeah. I loved it so, so much. But what does that kind of shift feel like? And how did you, as a young woman at that stage in your career, how did you adjust for that? I think it would be so good for so many women listening to hear.
It was pretty surreal. One, because I was a journalist before I started at The View, and it was really drilled into me to not talk about my personal life or mm-hmm. or just kind of, you know, just be cautious about expressing too much. And then here I am on The View, sitting next to Barbara Walters and Meredith Vieira and Star Jones, and Meredith Vieira is asking if I'm a virgin or not on my first day at work. To which I replied, my dad's watching right now, so I'll just say yes. I think that I try hard to keep most of my life private, things that are really, really personal. But I do think that by sharing bits and pieces, I do think that people feel like they can trust me even more. I mean, I think Meredith Vieira, the same thing happened for her. She kind of deviated from that characterization of what a reporter should reveal. And I think it served her well because people came to really like her and feel for her when she was going through, you know, issues with her husband who had MS or, you know, raising three kids and being a working mom. And it wasn't intentional for me. I think in a way, going to The View was helpful because, again, not only did I come from a journalism background, but I'm Asian. Mm-hmm. So Asian culture is probably the least communicative, the most shut down community there is, ethnic community. And so it was a real shift for me to be expressive and to do so on a national television, in front of a national television audience.
Mm-hmm. It must have been a bit of a culture shock.
For sure. Oh, for sure. It was so uneasy. But
so how did you keep coming in every day?
You know, I think that I was pretty cautious about what I was willing to talk about and what I didn't want to talk about. But I got myself into trouble a few times because it is a show that really encourages candor. And it was one of the few that did so. It was, you know, The View is it was a pioneer at the time because, you know, you had journalists sitting at this table and they were, you know, talking about everything happening in their lives. But it was, I think, as much as I wasn't crazy about the job, I think I developed skills there that have served me well. Because I do think that people relate to you more if you let them in a little bit. But it's still important to have boundaries, of course.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, God, I think about that so much because I want to have really vulnerable conversations about humanity with people. I want to investigate those things. I want to share about things that I'm learning, also to kind of undo that horrible two-dimensional projection of social media, which makes everybody feel like anyone in the public eye has their life figured out. It's like, Newsflash, none of us know. Nobody knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
The most successful people in the world will admit that they feel like tomorrow is going to be the day where everyone finds out they don't know what they're doing, you know?
Right, right.
And I loved hearing Oprah say that no matter who she ever interviewed, at the end of the interview when the cameras would stop, they would lean toward her and go, "Did I do okay?" Mm. From presidents to Beyonce, everyone just wants to know that they did okay.
Yeah.
And it is tricky when you really want to share, but then how much do you share, and what do you keep private? And I think especially for us as women, you know, I haven't done this yet, but you have. When you become a mom, you can only hide that for so long. The world is gonna know you're pregnant.
Yeah.
They're gonna know you had a baby. How do you set boundaries around what you share about the family people know you have? And I imagine it's very complicated.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I'm not like a huge celebrity. So I think and maybe I'm being naive because I probably share more than I should, because I became a parent when I was a little bit older. So it's like every little thing that my kids do, like I'm just so proud of it and excited. But at the same time, I do think that there are, you know, there are dangers to that. And on the one hand, while I think as a culture we are sharing so much, we also are conveying, you know, and I think everyone does this, right? That things, like I think our social media life is the life that we want people to see that we live, right? And I actually wish that people would be more vulnerable. And I mean, there are a few people out there who do, but I think that's one of the reasons why, when I was talking about how when we kind of showed that vulnerability, we're on a live stage, right? And so you can't put a filter on that like you can on Instagram, you know? Whatever just comes out of your mouth comes out of your mouth. But with social media now, you can perfect every image and you can choose what you decide to show the world, which is empowering on the one hand. But on the other hand, I think it's really made a whole generation of young people feel so much more insecure. In so many ways, it's, you know, the worst aspects of high school and popularity magnified, you know, and you're right. Nobody has it figured out, you know, but for some reason we now exist in this world where we feel compelled to convey that we have, or that life is great. When more people are, I mean, I don't know, Sophia, if you feel this, but I've been in a little bit of a funk in the last couple of weeks, because I just feel like people are really hurting right now, you know, just hearing about how many suicides have happened. You know, my good friend is the vice provost of wellness at USC. And he texted me to say that in the last 3 weeks, there have been 5 suicides there, 2 in 2 days. There's something going on right now where young people are just, they're hurting. And in the past, I think I mean, young people have always had angst, right? But in the past, they would have sought out human beings. And now they're just going straight to their devices. And in some cases, digging themselves deeper into a hole.
Yeah, because the devices perpetuate the lie that everyone else has it all figured out.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about you, but when I see a bunch of girlfriends get together for dinner and they didn't call me, like I feel a little like stab in the heart. Like,
of course.
I was here, but I get over it because it's, you know, it's just like that sort of momentary kind of pang. But for young people who in so many ways don't feel like life is worth living if it's not on social media, it's devastating. It's really devastating. And so, you know, on the one hand, I think if we show our vulnerabilities, I think it makes or allows people to relate to us. But, you know, what are we really showing?
Yeah, and yet it feels so important. I sometimes when I get nervous to share something that might be, you know, quote unquote too personal, I think I almost feel like it's a duty to do so because so much of what's being shared is impersonal.
Yeah.
And I think about how we can all kind of walk in the world and press toward kindness or self-acceptance or exploration or curiosity. And I think we could really use it. And it's part of the reason that I'm so glad your show is on. Like, really, I'm so relieved. And yeah, I guess I get curious about the evolution of that as well, because, you know, you went from The View, you ended up working for Oprah as an investigative reporter, which has just got to be the coolest thing ever.
It's pretty cool.
Because also, you think about that. I mean, her show was such a touch point for so many people to learn about each other. And to be vulnerable.
Yeah, I miss that show so much. I think we all miss it.
I'm like, please just come back.
Yeah.
I know you did it and you served your time, and it's probably really nice to be retired on your ranch, but please come back.
Yeah. I miss that, just that thoughtful dialogue every day. It's really hard to find that. I mean, you know, that fortunately there are podcasts, but to have that staple every day.
When you got there, well, first of all, how did you get there? And then what kinds of stories were you asked to cover?
So I went on the Oprah show to promote an episode that I had done for the National Geographic Channel. At the time, I was hosting a show called Explorer. Mm. And I believe it was an episode about incarcerated mothers that we produced. And the Oprah show asked me to come on and promote it, or they agreed to allow me to come on and promote it. And Oprah and her team were, I think they were really touched by the episode, but they were looking for someone to sort of send out into the world to cover those kinds of stories. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, it was the greatest honor of my life to have been asked to work on her show. But it was always so surreal when I would be sitting next to her and trying to explain what I had just done, and I look up and there she is. But I'm certain I wouldn't be doing what I am doing now if she and her team hadn't taken a risk on me or brought me into their fold. And same with The View. As much as I, you know, was challenged to be there, because it was an awkward kind of job. You know, they were all sort of steps to get to where I am now. But Oprah believing in me and encouraging me to tell these kinds of stories, and her own just genuine curiosity really I think is the reason I'm doing this. You know, she gave me the platform to be able to do that on such a widespread level, and I will always be so grateful for that.
Yeah. Is there a story in particular from that time that really sticks out in your mind, something that just felt so huge?
Many of them continue to live with me, but when she sent me to the Democratic Republic of the Congo to work on a story about gang rape, about these villages that would just be torn apart and ransacked, and the things that children were forced to watch happen to their mother or even take part in. It was so devastating. You know, whenever I would show up, I would see the audience and I would think to myself, oh my God, you came here probably to like get a car. And here I'm going to be talking about gang rape in the Congo. But the audience, her audiences were always incredible and so receptive. And in one episode of television, I think that about $3 million was raised for the organization that I accompanied to report that story. It might not have been that airing. It might have been like multiple airings, but cumulatively about $3 million was raised. And that's when I recognized, one, the power of Oprah. I mean, you know, of course, we all know her to be, you know, she's Oprah, but that people really did want to know about things that were happening in the world.
Yes.
And that it required someone like Oprah, right, to say, look, I know there's a lot happening in the world, and it's hard to get invested in people in faraway places, but here's why it's important that you're aware that this is happening. I mean, what she did for her audience is just, it's indescribable. It can never be replaced. And the impact that she made on so many people is just colossal. Mm-hmm.
That's so cool. What do you think you learned about yourself when you were working on that show?
What did I learn about myself? So much. I learned that everything that I do moving forward, every job that I ever take or do, I want to have an impact. I want to contribute positively to the conversation because I can. You can choose to contribute positively in what you do, in how you act, in what you put out into the universe. And watching her do so and getting an opportunity on her platform to be able to do that just really solidified that desire in me to just want to put productive energy out there into the world.
Productive energy. I like that. Now, you mentioned something earlier, and I just think it's an incredible story. You mentioned that your sister is also a journalist, and Laura was on assignment in North Korea.
She was on assignment in South Korea and China.
Ah.
Yeah. That was where we thought she was going. That's where she was. Yeah.
And she was held captive in North Korea for 5 months.
She and her team hired a fixer, someone who had worked with different television outlets before, to take them to observe the thoroughfare where people were escaping from North Korea and seeking refuge in China. So they hire this fixer to just show them where the line of demarcation is. And it is believed that he had nefarious intentions and intentionally took them to cross the border into North Korea. And when they realized that they had crossed into North Korea and they had turned around and they were heading back to the Chinese side, they heard soldiers yelling and they started to run, and they were firmly on the Chinese side of the border when North Korean soldiers crossed into another country, violated their national sovereignty, and violently dragged my sister and her colleague back into North Korea. So yeah, it was a pretty harrowing experience. And she was then held for 5 months inside a country with which we have no diplomatic relationship. And even though I had worked as a journalist for many, many years, you know, I thought that we could just pick up a phone and call and negotiate a release. But when two countries have no diplomatic relationship, you can't even do that. So it was a pretty arduous ordeal, to say the least, and terrifying.
I can't even fathom it. And I'm awestruck by what both of your experiences must have been on each end of that reality for 5 months. And I'm curious, to your point, because we have no relationship. And, you know, asterisk, what's happening now is utterly insane. And I wonder how you even begin, because you know the severity of the reality there as a journalist. And you worked so frantically to get her free, and it took so long. And I wonder how you even know where to start.
Well, you don't. I mean, I called everyone I knew, and over time I had developed, you know, quite a Rolodex of contacts in the world of diplomacy. And I tried to get in contact with everyone I could, and I was just, you know, I found myself at an impasse time and time again. People like Oprah called me to see if she could do anything, but even Oprah couldn't do anything. And you know, former presidents and secretaries of state. And really, it was my sister who convinced her captors that in order to achieve what they wanted, they had to allow her to call me. So you know, it was at a time when tensions were very high between our two countries. I mean, they're always tense, but President Obama was new in office. Hillary Clinton, she was brand new Secretary of State, and it was imperative for her to talk tough on North Korea and to not show weakness. And here, North Korea was trying to procure political concessions out of their captivity, and so it was a surreal time to be in the midst of that. And in the end, people may not recall that Bill Clinton was asked to be the envoy to go and negotiate the release of my sister and her colleague. And when he went over there, he said that the former leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-il, told him that the reason why the North Korean government insisted that Bill Clinton go and negotiate my sister's release was because he'd always wanted to meet him. He always wanted to meet Bill Clinton. And the reason was because when Kim Jong-il's father, the founder of North Korea, Kim Il-sung, died, Bill Clinton was the first world leader to call and offer his condolences, even before any of North Korea's allies called. And it was a gesture of humanity that he had never forgotten. And so, you know, and again, this goes back to communication. It all goes back to communication. And here you had two countries that have historically had this very contentious relationship, or as long as North Korea has existed, had this contentious relationship. But those gestures of humanity and diplomacy had an impact. Goes to show that even at that level, engagement can be really productive. You know, I think it's a lesson to learn for all of us on a macro scale, but also you know, on a very micro scale.
Wow. How do you think that experience affects the way that you think about traveling? Because when you talk about going somewhere like the Congo to expose rape as a weapon of war, or some of these other incredibly dangerous places, Afghanistan, that you've been to, how does having been through that with your sister, and I would imagine coupled with the reality of you being a parent, how does that affect at this stage in your career as a journalist where you will and won't go?
Well, now as a mother, I'm certainly more cautious about where I go, but I've never felt as strongly about promoting and supporting journalists who really do risk their lives to tell stories and to communicate things that are happening in the world. I mean, when I was doing most of my international work, the world was a different place. America was so highly regarded, and the world has changed. People don't feel the same way anymore. And so, again, the risks that journalists are taking now, I think, far outweigh those that I took as a younger journalist. But nevertheless, I do think that we need to exercise caution in choosing where we go, but actually going, I think, is more important than ever. Actually traveling to different parts of the world and embedding and immersing oneself in cultures that are unfamiliar, I think there's just so much value to that. And the way I looked at it when I would visit places that are known to be contentious is that for me, I would go in for a couple weeks max and then I would leave. But the people who live under those conditions have to do so every day of their lives. And so if I can somehow communicate a fraction of how they live or things that are happening in their lives, then I will have done my job and encourage people to know more about their lives. So yeah, for me, travel has been just without question the best education that I've ever received.
That's beautiful. And can I ask before we wrap up, truly, because I'm just curious about how you view this as a person with such incredible geopolitical knowledge and expertise. When we talk about your sister's story and we look at this destabilization of America's place in the world, mm-hmm. and how far down the ladder we've fallen as a respectable and sort of trustworthy world leader, looking at what's going on with Trump and North Korea right now, what do you make of all of this?
So, interestingly enough, when my sister was being held captive, it was communicated to me through her that the North Korean government just wanted to have dialogue. They wanted to have direct dialogue with the United States, and they hadn't really ever had that kind of direct dialogue. You know, there have been a number of secretaries of state who have interacted with the North Korean leadership, but in limited doses, right? And so it seems ludicrous what the Trump administration is doing. And in many ways, it is. And it's confounding to call someone who, to call a zealot like Kim Jong-un his buddy or his friend, and to say that he's in love with him is ludicrous. Someone who, you know, is at the helm of a country filled with gulags, where people who express dissent for the government can be tortured or worse. But I am a proponent of direct dialogue. I am, because whatever we've done in the past hasn't worked. And North Korea is the kind of country that the North Korean leadership is one where saving face, that sort of adheres to the principle of saving face. And when you're constantly sort of talking tough and antagonizing, you arrive at an impasse. And so I do think that constant engagement is something that could be productive. And so while I have, again, I am confounded by his approach to these relationships, because he's discounting the egregiousness of his behavior and his policies. I'm talking about Kim Jong-un. I am a proponent of having meaningful dialogue.
I guess I just wish it felt meaningful rather than, you know, and pardon the expression, but it feels very masturbatory to me. Like these two malignant narcissists are just stroking each other's ego, but that our leader is so naive to the reality that while he's having his ego stroked and enjoying it, North Korea is amassing nuclear warheads and testing them so flagrantly. You know, they're testing missiles to let us know that
and
its country
is on the verge of utter chaos and starvation, and that thousands of people are in gulags there. I mean, it's you know, there's you know, there's such male ego driving our policy, right?
So
there's no simple answer to that question. I'm confounded, but at the same time, I am a proponent of dialogue.
Sure.
I just don't think that's how we arrive at meaningful dialogue.
Right. Yeah. Agree.
Yeah.
Interesting. Cool. Thank you. I just wanted to pick your brain on that. When we get into the show now, when we talk about This Is Life, premiered in 2014 on CNN, for listeners, the first episode talked about sugar daddies and sugar babies, and since then you've covered everything from life in prison to the Satanic Temple, female MMA fighters, children of killers, gender fluidity. I mean, so many incredible topics. And as you mentioned, you immerse yourself in these communities. You really get in there and do the work of becoming familiar and listening and offering real intimate understanding to people. I'm curious how you pick the topics, because as a person who is so interested in so many things, I'm always so relieved. I'm like, God, I wanted to know about that, and I wanted to know about this. And you're in all of it. And I'm curious how you decide, and at times how you become aware of some of these niche communities.
Well, my team and I are pretty voracious consumers of information. Mm. And every season we'll put together a pretty exhaustive list of things that we want to cover. And CNN ultimately greenlights the eight that we move forward on. But what we do try to do every season is pick a number of pretty hard-hitting, provocative, but very relevant topics. This season, our season premiere is about pornography addiction. And, you know, porn has been in existence forever. Mm-hmm. People have become addicted to porn forever. But the pornography that young kids are getting exposed to today, mm-hmm. as you know, at earlier ages than ever before, the age of entry in most cases is 8. And to say that it's extreme is to grossly understate the severity of what kids are getting exposed to on devices that live on their bodies. Mm. It's having a tremendous impact on how kids are perceiving sex, relationships, because once you see the things that they can access at the tip of their fingertips, they can't erase it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's embedded in their minds forever. And parents need to realize that the moment you give your child the device, they're going to have access to this, no matter what restrictions you have. Mm-hmm. If you just put the word porn into Google and click on images, you will be appalled by what comes up. And so that is an issue that, again, it is having such an impact on the way young people are perceiving relationships. Mm-hmm. And really, I think young people are now currently unable to even have healthy relationships as a result of what they've seen.
Yes.
Which is so different than the porn that we were exposed to when we were kids. Mm-hmm. I mean, it couldn't be more different. We have a piece about benzodiazepines, which I believe could possibly become the next opioid crisis. We're talking about Valium, Xanax, Ativan, Klonopin. If we've never been prescribed them, we know people who are probably taking them and have been taking them for a long time. Our episode is shocking, it's important, it's illuminating, and I think people need to wake up. You know, these are medications that are supposed to treat anxiety, yet we're more anxious than we've ever been.
Yes.
So we take on a number of pretty heavy topics, but we also have an episode about swingers and an episode about the bond between identical twins. Mm. So we try to vary it up, and it's really, I think that if you watch an entire season, you will, you'll just have so many unique experiences. And if we do our jobs right, we will have compelled you and provoked you to really think about things that you might have otherwise not thought about, and talk about things that you might have otherwise not thought to talk about.
It's so exciting to me. And I think it's so cool that you're exploring this gamut of topics from, you know, your point about the twins. I'm fascinated by that sort of ability to feel phantom pain that twins have and that sort of knowing that they experience.
Yeah, it's such a beautiful episode. I've also been just really fascinated by identical twins. And, you know, you were asking me, how do you come up with the topics? Really, as I told you, as a kid, I have always had this insatiable curiosity, and to be able to do a show and pitch, you know, cultures and worlds and topics that I'm just fascinated by is pretty cool.
Yeah. And from simply fascinating to taboo and to not shy away from any of them.
Yeah, because again, you know, we are all part of the same race. You know, we are human beings, and I've always believed that the more we know about each other, the better we become, the smarter we become, and ultimately the better we become.
Absolutely. What advice do you have for young people who want to get into investigative journalism?
Well, if your intention is to become rich and famous, you're in the wrong line of work. But if you do have an insatiable curiosity, if you think about yourself as a sponge that just derives pleasure from absorbing as much as you can, it's still a pretty incredible line of work to be exposed to so many different kinds of things and worlds and people is really exciting. And for those who are wanting to pursue it, I would say leave your comfort zone. Learn to write. Write about when you leave your comfort zone. And, you know, there are more outlets available to journalists and aspiring journalists than ever before. Again, you may not make a tremendous amount of money by submitting your work, but there are more outlets for it to be read or seen than ever before.
Yeah.
So I would say go for it, because I think it's a pretty exciting time in the world of journalism. It's a very different time than when I first started, but there are a lot of opportunities.
That's exciting. And what do you think? I'm sure there's been a lot, but is there a piece of best advice that stands out to you that you received over the course of your career thus far?
God, there are so many sort of quotes that live in my head, right? But for me, I've always just tried to be a really good listener. I know that's cliche, but in that we've really stopped hearing each other, I think it's never been more important to convey the importance of being a good listener.
Yeah. So the title of the podcast is called Work in Progress. And I'm curious, when you hear that phrase, what comes to mind as something that you are still or currently in progress in your life?
So much, Sophia. I mean, it's to your point when we first started about how we're all trying to figure it out. You know, when you introduced me, you expressed this really impressive bio, right? I've done a lot of things. I've worked with some extraordinary people. I've worked for some incredible outlets, but every day is a journey. And I love absorbing every day. And that's why I feel so honored to be able to do what I do. It's why I love to feel so much, because I want to be able to remember every day that I'm alive. You know, I don't want to do things in a perfunctory way, and I don't want things to get stagnant. I really would like to remember something about every day that I'm alive, because you know, our space in this universe is not infinite. Yeah, and I feel really privileged to be able to be invited into so many different worlds. And if I can be that catalyst for people becoming more aware, for developing a little more compassion, for feeling, just feeling at all, then that's something that makes me really proud.
I love that. Thank you.
Thank you.
This show is executive produced by me, Sophia Bush, and Sim Sarna. Our supervising producer is Allison Bresnick. Our associate producer is Caitlin Lee. Our editor is Josh Windisch. And our music was written by Jack Garrett and produced by Mark Foster. This show is brought to you by Clarion Anatomy.